Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a panel discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with the Department of International Relations at Boston University. Speaking will be Angelos Pangratis, Deputy Head of Delegation of the European Commission in the United States, Wanwan Shen, Research Fellow at Harvard University's Center for the Environment China Project, and Shelley Hawks, Assistant Professor of Social Sciences at BU's College of General Studies. We begin with a greeting by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross.
Good evening and welcome. Tonight we'll consider for the first time China's growing economic and geopolitical influence, and in particular how China's new position on the world stage is influencing and shaping Europe, the United States, and the transatlantic relationship. We are very fortunate to have today with us three outstanding speakers representing very different experiences. Our main speaker is Angelos Pangratis. Dr. Pangratis is Deputy Head of Delegation of the European Commission in the United States. Previously, he was Ambassador and Head of Delegation for the European Commission's mission in Argentina. And from 1998 to 1903, he was Head of Unit responsible for relations with European Union's relations with China, Hong Kong, Macau, Taiwan, South Korea, and Mongolia. He has held several other positions during his distinguished career in the European Commission, and he has lectured at universities in the Czech Republic, France, and Korea. He holds a doctorate in international economics, monetary politics, and finance from the Sorbonne. Dr. Wanwan Shen is from China. She's currently research fellow at Harvard University's Center for the Environment China Project, lecturer in the Department of Economics at Brandeis University, and visiting professor at Tsinghua University School of Law. She is a graduate of the People's University in Beijing and Harvard Law School, and holds a doctorate in law from the University of Wisconsin. She has written extensively on human rights and women's issues in contemporary China. Responding is Shelley Drake Hawks, Assistant Professor of Social Sciences at Boston University's College of General Studies. Professor Hawks' primary research and teaching fields include the history of 20th century China, U.S.-China relations during the Cold War, Mao Zedong, and the assault on tradition during the Cultural Revolution, and creativity and protest in contemporary Chinese life. A historian by training, she worked previously in the commercial art world and in the Asiatic Department at the Museum of Fine Arts. Dr. Pangratis.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for this introduction. Thanks to the Institute of Human Sciences and the Boston University for this very nice opportunity. First point, just a few facts on the relative importance of the EU-US economic relationship compared with the US-China relationship. I think it's important as a starting point to our discussion to stress that despite the media excitement about the rise of China, and not only the media excitement, United States and Europe remain by far its other most important economic partner. In fact, the EU-US trade is actually about the double of what US trades with China. Roughly, we are talking about $500 billion compared with $250 billion. On trade in services, the EU-US relationship is worth more than 215 billion euros per year. In fact, this amount is clearly bigger than the whole trade, external trade of China with the whole world in terms of services. On foreign investment, the comparison is even more important. In 2004, for example, the U.S. invested in France alone around $7 billion. This is almost the double of what the U.S. invested in China the same year. Europe accounts for about 75% of total foreign investment in the United States. The part of China is it's very small. The transatlantic, what we call the transatlantic economy, in fact, employs 14 million workers on both sides of the Atlantic, 7 million on each side of the Atlantic. So that's a point that we should not forget. Second point, when we talk about China, immediately I think in all our minds we talk about challenges. Let's think quickly about some key challenges. Challenges China faces and also challenges China represents. First, in terms of the internal politics of China, big issue, we know the contradiction between an economy that is getting more and more free and the political system which is not necessarily following the same path. What we see in China, I just mentioned three or four, I think, examples of interest. Hu Jintao, China, raised a lot of expectations when Hu Jintao came in power for a new wave of political reforms. I think in a nutshell what we see, however, now is a quite strong continuation of the suppression of debate. We see on the positive side a focus on rural poverty, government austerity, and anti-corruption. On the negative side, we see crackdown on liberties, crackdown on internet, particularly, and on NGOs. We see a general tendency of centralization of state and party power, and I think the 2008 Olympics, they play a role in this respect. On the more positive side, we see a strong concentration of China's official policy around the peaceful rise or development concept, which is a little bit the opposite of the threat dimension, which is very often projected from the Western world to the China, and I will come back to that to that concept. From the international policy and the international politics point of view, the challenge is obvious. The economic rise of China is accompanied by what we can call geopolitical rise of the global influence of China, and this is not happening without some difficulties. We see the effects of that rise, particularly on a regional basis, North East Asia, where I would argue we see the biggest changes in the modern world in terms of the geopolitical balance, but also the influences in other parts of Asia and also in the relations with India. On a global scale, China is very careful in international politics, on global issues, but we see a very clear projection of its power and influence around the basic need that it has for ensuring energy supplies. The access to oil issue is the motivation for a very active initiatives from China in Central Asia and with difficult countries and sometimes in ways that create some difficulties in the relations with Europe and the U.S. In the case of countries like Iran, Africa, Russia, Latin America. When we think about challenges and risks, I think it's very important to realize, at least in our perception of our approach to China, the major economic risk that we see in China does not come from the scenarios of growth and success of China. They come from the scenarios of failure or instability. I think it's important to realize that. This is the worst case scenario that we can have. And the risk of failure or instability has not disappeared completely. China is doing extraordinary things on the positive things on the positive side. It has aspects of fragility. And I just mentioned a few very quickly. Growing inequality. Before reforms, China was among the more equal distribution countries in the world. Now it's at the other end. The inequality of income distribution is very high. Regional disparities, parts of China, you have highly paid, highly efficient parts Downtown Shanghai is part of the world financial best, and somewhere more to the deep country you have salaries of $1 per day. Environmental concerns, air and water pollution, soil erosion, deforestation, steady decline in water table, especially in the north, corruption, lack of transparency, difficulty of the system to deal with this challenge, very difficult with a concentrated political system to deal with corruption and transparency, and a very still fragile banking sector, which is a very worrying element, because in an economy that grows so spectacularly, we still have an extremely fragile banking sector. Important to realize the reaction. I think there is a small difference up to now in the way we react to this rise of China from the trade point of view. Both us and the U.S., we see flames of protectionism growing in parallel with the increase of the trading power of China. We both react with some anti-dumping, some protection measures. But globally, we tend to not concentrate our reaction on sectoral protection, but on a rather coordinated global macroeconomic adjustment, encouraging China to boost domestic demand, to modernize its inefficient financial system, and to reduce the need for savings. Key question, what are the chances of China to also become a technology giant? Just very briefly, huge challenge. We overestimate the steps that have been achieved up to now. China is extremely dependent upon the multinational companies and foreign technology. Turning to the European Union-China relations, these relations have developed very rapidly. It's due in great part to the growing trade relationship, but it's also due to the fact that the EU was able to adopt a much more coherent policy towards China. If you look at the external relations of the EU, you will see that the China policy is a very special animal. In fact, it's a case where the EU has managed to maintain a very high coherence of policy. A lot of the policy is coordinated at the EU level with great success. It's a case where the EU as such has achieved one of the highest degrees of coherence of action. And this is true for the last at least 15 years. And it's, we see this reinforced every day. Of course, there are some differences among member states, but you will find comparatively very few. China itself has made good relations with the EU a priority foreign policy objective for itself. There are several reasons: the multipolar world, the way the need to, for them to be able to have more policy space towards the United States, all these influence this line, which is very clear, though, and has clearly influenced the relations. So where do we stand today on the EU-China relations? We have clearly a policy of engagement. There is no doubt, there's no second thoughts, there is only one way. We need to engage and build on that. The last 5 years were very important years from that point of view. The relations have become more complex. I will give you a few examples of what we have done. And we are preparing now to issue, maybe September, October, a new strategy towards China, on our relations with China, reflecting these new dimensions. As an illustration of the progress achieved in 2005, we have concluded a textile agreement. When we get into trade frictions, in fact, we found a negotiated solution. In 2004, we brought China into Galileo. You know, Galileo is the satellite navigation system that Europe is preparing, huge issue with very difficult dimensions of technology control or transfer, even security implications. But we made a very fundamental, very important agreement of bringing China into Galileo, not to the extent that it wanted, but still. And also in 2004, we signed what we call the ADS tourism agreement, which is not as only tourism as it looks, because it has a dimension also of facilitating repatriation, which is very important for us. It's related to the immigration challenge that we have with Chinese immigrants. At present, we are preparing an agreement on civil aviation and the full readmission agreement, which is a huge concern for the EU and the US as well. We have a relationship which is also unique in other respects. In fact, we maintain with China a global dialogue, which is, one can call it a strategic dialogue, really, on global issues, issues of global interest, but also on sectoral, on important sectors. I just mentioned some of them: energy, environment, new climate change, partnership, and others. EU is the second largest trading partner of China, and in fact we are now exploring the possibilities of starting a partnership and cooperation agreement, which a few years ago was considered completely impossible. It has elements of human rights, for example, involved. Quite impressive results, honestly. Quite a dynamic interaction, a very rich and constructive engagement, but it's also very important to state that at the same time that we see the relations building up and the two partners getting really into a partnership, we see very clearly a number of concerns rising too. And these are part of the challenge of the future. Just to mention a few, of course, the one that comes immediately in mind is the trade deficit. We are not enormously concerned about that. We have 100 billion, more or less, deficit. It's an important deficit, but the EU does not have the deficit, the overall deficit that the United States has, so we are not enormously concerned about that. We are more concerned about the market access to China. There is something unbalanced and there is some unfair elements in the relationship with China, seen from our point of view as from the US point of view. It's okay to have a deficit, but you have to at least to be treated fairly at the other end. And although China has done a lot of progress since its accession to the WTO, there is a lot to do. And some of you must have noticed that for the first time, EU and the US, we started a WTO consultation procedure on auto parts against China. It's the first time where the two partners take an action at the same time toward China. It's something that says a lot to those who follow this triangular relationship. A more difficult issue for the transatlantic relationship is the question of the EU arms embargo. You know, we have an embargo towards China. We were more or less decided to remove it. Very strong reaction from the US. Let me just clarify that at no point the intention of the EU was to increase arms sales to China. We have a code of conduct of control of arms export. And the European Council said several times that even if we lift the embargo, this will not mean that arms export of arms will increase to China, because the idea was to lift the embargo and reinforce the control of exports. It is true that lifting the embargo has a kind of symbolic value, and it's not an easy decision politically to take, and it has consequences. This is left aside for the time being mainly because of the strong reaction of the US. We have huge concerns about human rights. Human rights in China, it's an issue on which we share very much the same views with the US. This is not a situation where China has an issue in which China has made sufficient progress, and this is an issue on which the public opinion in Europe is somehow on a different line with the policymakers. The official policy is negotiate, get involved, try to convince China to move. In fact, I was the head of the negotiating team for the European Commission during 4 years on the human rights with China, And I must tell you, it's a quite frustrating process. Progress is not really that impressive nor that quick, and we have not seen much happening since then. On international issues, there are some positive noises to make there, in the sense that, as I said, on multilateral issues, global issues, China is very careful globally, has a positive role, continues to raise his engagement in multilateral efforts, and also as UN peacekeeping, in UN peacekeeping efforts, and it's started taking more positive international initiatives, like, for example, the last conference that they organized on avian flu, the multinational conference on avian flu. Our policy is to try to involve them more and make them a more responsible partner, and from that point of view, we are completely on the same line with the U.S. I mentioned already the issue of the energy supplies. I repeat it just to say, from the global perspective and on the global issues point of view, that's probably there where we start seeing emerging attitudes which are worrying and which are disturbing and which, to some extent, show that there are margins for different interpretation and for different positions between the Western world, the US, EU, and China. Of course, we have the issue of Taiwan. On that issue, too, we are in a very similar position with the U.S. We accept the one-China policy, but we want a peaceful resolution of the conflict, of the dispute, not a conflict, hopefully. And, of course, we want a solution which is acceptable to the Taiwanese people. And from that point of view, the EU, during the last couple of years, has become much more active. We have issued policy declarations. We follow the events that are happening there, and we try to influence the process in a more proactive attitude. Where do we go from here? Just a few ideas, a few orientation. What is the future going to be like? Of course, that's always difficult to say, but what we see overall is, as I said, a much deeper, much wider, deeper and wider relationship between EU and China. And at the same time, as the difficulties or the difficult issues also increase, we tend to see that as a more realistic relationship. We moved from the situation where maybe 5 years ago, where China was hoping that the EU will be the other pillar in the world, in a multipolar world, and we were, or at least some, were seeing China as a strategic partner that really will create a new axis of power in the world. I think we moved in a more realistic relationship, more balanced relationship, where we have a lot in common, a lot to do together, and a lot of challenges to face together, and where the whole spectrum of this relationship is very much conditioned by the force of the transatlantic relationship. I had a small reference of Robert Jelic comment. He said that we want a China which is a responsible stakeholder. I think this is an idea which is on which we are really building the relationship now, right now, and we are on the same global line with the U.S. On that. In the negotiation of the new partnership and cooperation agreement that I mentioned, for us this is a very strategic instrument. We hope that we will see. We need a couple of breakthroughs at political level on that. We hope that we will see this happening, and this will be the key instrument of building the relationship for the future. Overall, the EU and U.S., I think we share towards China not only the same fundamental values, but we also pursue many identical objectives. I mentioned the way we see the key issues, the way we see the overall evolution. We agree that China's rise is an opportunity and not a threat, despite the discussion that might be around sometimes in the press or from many analysts, which are legitimate discussions, but overall it's an opportunity, it's not a threat. And we agree that containment is not an option. We need positive engagement, and we need a realistic engagement. Overall, I tend to believe very much that the rise of China, from every point of view, it's not only economic, it's not only trade, it's global, it's geopolitical. So the rise of China, and also the rise of India, by the way, is probably the more certain and the more profound challenge that we have to face in the 21st century. We need, between the EU and the US and in a triangular, sound relation with China, to ensure that this rise is peaceful and it's done in a way that contributes to global prosperity and contributes to the prosperity of the peoples of all the parties involved. Thank you very much for your attention.
Good evening. Thank you very much, Professor Gross and Professor Hawkes, to invite me to your prestigious institute. I'm truly honored tonight to be here with our distinguished guest speaker, Ambassador Parastis. I will make a very quick, short respond to Ambassador Pangaratas' speech, and followed by a more detailed discussion on two issues I think is very critical in U.S.-China trade relation today. One is trade frictions between U.S. and China, and then two, the intellectual property problems in China. I just want to emphasize, especially in the situation in the context of a trade, especially today's world, trade is ultimately a global system because of the diversity in the condition of production, including capital, technology, and labor. All this diversity among the different regions and nations are better off if they utilize their comparative advantage to trade with each other or among each other. My second point is the world would be much better off if China is integrated in the system of trade, investment, environment protection, and other exchange with U.S. and the EU both, you know, at the same time. I give example. In recent years, the EU-China dialogue on the human rights, you already mentioned that, and the cooperation on environment protection, both seems more effective, I have to say here, productive and effective than U.S.-China relation on the same area, on human rights and environment protection. From my own work for European nation government, I did the project review for Dutch government on their project legal cooperation between Dutch Netherlands and then with China. I find that the EU has been quite active and effective through the small grant project directed to Chinese scholars, NGOs, and as well as some important government organizations in order to improve China's records on human rights and environment protection. I give example means just to show when you have this dynamic, you know, the multi triangle, we'll say, relationship in the U.S.-China relation will not work well on the human rights or environment protection sometime, and then China-EU, you know, produce some result. I think that is much effective for China and help China to improve its human rights and environment protection, and it's better for the whole world. And then also, you mentioned some numbers. I think EU-US trade versus the US-China trade. I'm not trying to sound to compete for US attention here, but I think the trend lines are more favoring interaction with China now. That is, the rate of growth is much greater in China, and will continue to be that way. To clarify this, it's not to suggest that the trade volume, you know, the more the better, especially with such a trade imbalance between the U.S. and China. So I will discuss this in a minute about how the rapid growth of exports from China led to the various trade conflict with U.S. and then to some degree is poisoning U.S.-China relation too. So First is trade fiction. Senator Schumer and Graham kicked off a trip to China carrying their sponsored bill that would impose penalty tariffs of 27.5% on all Chinese goods coming into the country because China's currency policy. And after coming back from China, the two senators decided to delay the vote on the trade penalty bill. And meanwhile, the USTR filed a trade case against China in the WTO, and then 25-nation EU joined this complaint, which alleged that China is imposing high tax on the imported auto parts in violation of the pledge China made when China joined the WTO 4 years ago. Before the new case joined by EU, the United States was the only country ever to file a WTO complaint against China. That early case involved China tax break for semiconductor chips was resolved during the consultation phases. So what this tells us is that a lot of trade conflicts between China, the U.S., and between China and the EU, and with other countries too. I often tell my students in China often get upset to see that they feel the hostile, the feeling from outside world towards China. And I say to them, you have to live with that. This is normal. It's inevitable when a growing trade giant, over the last 20 years to have trade frictions with EU and with China. If we look back to the history of the emergence of the U.S. between 1870 to 1900, and then Japan's emergency between 1950 to 1980. And we find that the emergence of China and the Chinese economy between 1980 to 2010, probably, the same 30 years, you see China probably easily rival the speed of both U.S. and Japan. So what's wrong with this, this rapid growth? So one of the particular problems have been posed by this rapid integration of China into global economy for high-income countries like the United States and the EU is the import from China to United States especially have been mostly labor-intensive manufactured goods. And according to economic theory, that should push down the wage of low-skilled labor. Moreover, China has a rapid growth bilateral trade surplus with the U.S. Ambassador already mentioned the $200 billion now. Even according to Chinese data, the question arises as to whether the import from China primarily displaced the U.S. domestic production, by pushing down significantly on the wage of low-skilled workers employed in these industries, or whether these imports simply replace the imports from third countries, from elsewhere, not replace the U.S.-made goods. So U.S. trade deficit with Asia is as a whole, it remains relatively stable. To make foregoing points is not to suggest Chinese government should not re-examine the two decades-long policy of export. This export-driven economy, has been at the huge cost of its environment and its labor relations. So after saying that, I want to add the one point is we needed to learn how to live with the trade conflicts. We know there have been 45 EU-US trade disputes filed in WTO over the last 10 years, ranging from the EU refusal to allow the imports to hormone treated beef from U.S. and despite the WTO's ruling, and to the disputes concerning trademark copyright subsidies on Airbus. Among them, more than 10 are currently active. This is the EU and the U.S. trade disputes. According to the expert on EU-U.S. trade relations, even though EU-U.S. trade accounts for less than 22% of EU trade, it has over 47% of EU WTO disputes. So by giving this example, my point is that the existence of the trade disputes became a part of the growing process. It's perfectly normal and it's almost it's almost inconceivable, for such a major power to have no trade conflicts. So now I want to move to the issue of intellectual properties. Chinese law concerning intellectual property has grown persistently in quality and in quantity over the past 20 years. And China has also joined all major international organizations, a law on the intellectual property, such as WIPO and the Berne Convention, WTO TRIPS. However, the commercial piracy is still a very serious issue in China. Still using U.S. as an example, U.S.'s copyrighted products contributed 6% to U.S. economy, and 50% of them generated overseas. So it's just the stake involved for U.S. The difficulty lies mostly in effective enforcement. And as we know, China, you have local protectionism and also lack of adequate sanction or criminal prosecutions. Finally, I want to say China's own demand for intellectual property law and protection has been growing recently. Some Chinese companies are working on advanced technology and care about intellectual property. And this is important only if you yourself care about intellectual property, and then you will protect the others' rights too. In February, one U.S. business became the first company sued for patent infringement by mainland Chinese plaintiffs in federal court in Texas, alleging the infringement of its U.S. patent relating to USB. You guys have a computer, right? You know that what's called a USB flash memory drive. And so it's a Chinese patent. So they filed a lawsuit in this country. So according to the Fortune magazine, while the case may strike America as a man by the dog story, because every time people are always thinking, is China infringing U.S.'s patent, copyright, trademark. Now China is suing U.S. here. The many specialists see this as a long-anticipated intellectual property milestone. Presumably, more will be in the future. Thank you.
Good evening, and it's a pleasure to be here with Ambassador Pongratis and Dr. Shen, and thank you, Professor Gross. China's rapid economic growth and rising influence in global foreign policy is likely to shake up the international order as we know it. Dramatic shifts in the balance of power are visible on the horizon, and these shifts present profound challenges for world diplomacy. While Europe and the United States are competitors in selling products to the China market, Europe and the U.S. have a mutual interest in preserving stability in East Asia and should not work at cross purposes, and I think the ambassador agrees with this. And last year's decision not to rescind the EU's post-Tiananmen arms embargo and thus not allowing France and other nations to sell advanced defense technology to the PRC was a positive signal that the Europe appreciates the fragile dynamics in East Asia right now and the critical role that the U.S. plays in maintaining stability in the Taiwan Straits. Now, there are two major flashpoints in East Asia right now, North Korea and Taiwan, and both situations are pushing the U.S. and Japan to deepen their military partnership to a degree that's never been seen before, including the construction of a joint missile defense program. As for North Korea, the issue centers on its nuclear program and its frequent test launching of missiles in the Sea of Japan. The Bush administration's diplomatic initiative, the six-party talks, has stalled, and in the interim, China appears to have deepened its ties with Kim Jong-il's regime and drawn closer to South Korea as well. China's closer ties with both Koreas coincides with a rise in anti-Japanese sentiment in the PRC, centered on Japan's perceived failure to apologize for misconduct during World War II. And competition between China and Japan to secure energy resources has also given rise to territorial disputes over gas reserves in the East China Sea. But I'll spend the balance of my time discussing the second flashpoint, and that is the issue of Taiwan, a high-stakes controversy that's bedeviled U.S.-China relations over the last half century. And even when the Taiwan controversy seems to be quiet, it continues to drive policy decisions and can erupt like a volcano. And my hope is that more focused diplomatic attention to this issue can avert further erosion in the bilateral relationship between China and the U.S. Now, since President Nixon went to China in 1972 and President Carter normalized relations with China in 1979, the U.S. and the PRC have worked out an effective set of arrangements on Taiwan, and it's known as the One China Policy. And this settlement was devised within the context of the Cold War when the U.S. and China needed each other to jointly oppose the Soviet threat. But this One China Policy is still valuable today because it's been successful in steering the two sides away from confrontation. Its main parameters are as follows. Ambiguity on the central issue of sovereignty. It's on this basis that the U.S. agrees not to support a formal declaration of independence by Taiwan. And furthermore, the U.S. discontinued official diplomatic relations with Taiwan, transferring those official relations to the PRC. Now, number two, insistence on a peaceful settlement of the dispute by the Chinese themselves. And here the PRC agreed to refrain from military intervention as long as Taiwan does not unilaterally secede. Now, number three, America agreed to sever its defense alliance with Taiwan and to withdraw from military bases on Taiwan. However, Congress passed the Taiwan Relations Act in 1979, asserting the right to continue selling defensive arms to Taiwan until the tensions subside in the region. And these arms should be sufficient to strike a military balance that will deter the PRC from invading or blockading Taiwan, but not a blank check guaranteeing Taiwan's invulnerability. And the technology that U.S. proposes for sale to Taiwan is generally not cutting-edge weaponry. For example, current discussions center around diesel-powered submarines rather than more advanced nuclear models, and this is in deference to the high level of tension across the straits. Now, the basic premise of the One China Policy is to enforce a stalemate until the political situation is more conducive to negotiating a resolution. Now, this is why it's important for EU members not to sell advanced weapons technology to the PRC right now so the military balance can be achieved or preserved. The hope is that the PRC will eventually democratize and a genuine settlement can take place. To keep the peace in the meantime, the U.S. must constantly react to new developments and actively discourage unilateral steps by either side. And President Bush has correctly stepped up to the plate to publicly scold Taiwan's current president, Chen Shui-bian, for taking steps towards independence that he promised he wouldn't take, such as calling for a referendum or abolishing the National Unification Council. Now, you may remember that assertive claims by Taiwan's previous president, Lee Teng-hui, precipitated a serious military incident in 1996. The PRC leader at that time, Jiang Zemin, became infuriated with President Clinton when he reversed an earlier decision and granted Taiwan's president a visa to make a high-profile tour of the United States, culminating in a speech at Cornell University. The diplomatic attention afforded Lee set a new standard for unofficial relations, and the PRC reacted in anger at what they perceived as Lee behaving like a head of state. Shortly before Taiwan's presidential election, the PRC staged large-scale military exercises and fired missiles into the water just 15 miles offshore as a warning to voters and candidates not to steer Taiwan towards independence. The Clinton administration correctly sent U.S. aircraft cruisers to the straits to demonstrate that the U.S. would not tolerate a blockade should the military exercises continue. And although the episode was diffused quickly, worries have lingered. The PRC's military spending has increased rapidly since then. The PRC has large cash reserves, and not all of their spending is reported. So, and they also have increased the number of missiles pointed at Taiwan from China's southern coast. Now, every time a new weapon system is proposed for sale to Taiwan in the U.S. Congress, temperatures rise anew. Politicians need to be very careful that the proposed sales are really necessary to keep Taiwan safe. And the politics of the Taiwan issue makes it hard to show restraint since no U.S. politician wants to appear soft on communist China. And this is especially true when economic worries over the U.S. trade deficit and the loss of manufacturing jobs overseas converge with mounting fears of the Chinese military. Americans worry that the rise of China might bring about the fall of America. But politicians must put a brake on this alarmist outlook. They must strive for a balanced approach that takes responsibility for fixing America's ills, encouraging more savings and more economic competitiveness. On the Taiwan question, the U.S. must continue to play the mediator and stay in the safe middle position. To tilt toward Taiwan may be politically tempting for President Bush because of the pro-Taiwan views of his political base and the strategic value of Taiwan's location in safeguarding shipping lanes. But it's imperative that the president not drift toward a pro-independent stance. The PRC has made it clear that were the U.S. to endorse Taiwan's independence, this would be cause for war. Now, how likely is it that the PRC would risk its international reputation and economic sanctions to undertake a military attack? It's unlikely now, especially with the Beijing Olympics scheduled for 2008. But the prospect of a future invasion can no longer be ruled out, according to Donald Zagoria, a highly respected authority on U.S.-China relations. Americans should understand that on the Taiwan issue, the PRC will not let go. Resolving the issue of Taiwan is closely identified with China's long 20th century quest to restore national dignity by taking back the territories annexed by foreign powers when China was poor and weak. Japan took Taiwan from the Qing Dynasty in 1895, and China's Civil War and the Cold War prevented China from getting it back. A rough analogy might be to consider how Americans would feel if Hawaii had been annexed by Japan during the attack on Pearl Harbor and then never returned. On the other hand, Chinese should understand that the American public is overwhelmingly sympathetic to Taiwan's perspective. They admire Taiwan's progress in establishing a robust economy and a democratic system. Taiwan was America's loyal ally during the Cold War. But would Americans be willing to go to war over this issue? Definitely not. But war might come anyway, unless Americans strive to see a broader picture of the situation in East Asia. More Americans need to take an interest in learning about Chinese history and studying the language so that we can acquire the prerequisites for a more healthy relationship between our two rival nations. Universities and secondary schools have played a positive role fostering teacher and student exchanges with China and training both American and Chinese youth in critical reasoning. And business contacts have flourished. But many Americans of my generation still look at China through the single lens of the Tiananmen Massacre of 1989. While this was a critical watershed and a great tragedy, it shouldn't be the only reference point through which Americans evaluate China's progress. Many subtle changes have taken place in urban life as the party's iron grip has weakened. Today, there's a more lively give and take between a still authoritarian state and an increasingly independent society. Now, President Bush's tough-sounding rhetoric and his doctrine of preemptive war in the post-9/11 era could persuade hardliners in the PRC that America and Japan, and perhaps India, intend to paint China into a corner, and that a military intervention should be attempted before success drifts out of reach. A dark picture of America has become pervasive in PRC public opinion since the late 1990s. America is seen as a declining and violent superpower, desperate to prop up a corrupt international order at China's expense. For many Chinese intellectuals, America has replaced the Communist Party as the hated authority, the principal target towards which anger is directed. Americans might not realize that a very sinister view of America became commonplace after the 1999 bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade during the NATO-led airstrikes. Although it was characterized as accidental by the U.S. side, and official apologies and compensation payments were made to the victims' families, the Chinese never accepted this explanation. The Chinese believed that the U.S. was punishing China for its opposition to the war in Kosovo, and for its sympathy for the former Yugoslavia. For many Chinese who watched the media coverage on TV, the harrowing images of fellow Chinese killed by bombs in 1999 shattered their once benign image of the United States. Rock throwing and burning of American flags outside the U.S. Embassy in Beijing erupted in retaliation. Congress's investigation of the incident later revealed some disturbing details that make the Chinese contention that the bombing was deliberate more credible than was once thought. In 78 days of airstrikes, only one target was proposed by the CIA, and it was this one. Furthermore, an analyst for the Office of the Joint Chief of Staff's conducting backup checks on the proposed targets voiced concerns that the supply depot, which later turned out to be the Chinese embassy, was improperly described, and yet the target was approved without further investigation. Now, despite these negative trends I've mentioned that may develop into a new Cold War and a new arms race with China, there is cause for optimism. The lessons of Cold War history remind us not to overreact to China's rise in global power. The U.S. should send positive signals to the PRC and initiate confidence-building measures so that we don't drift into a vicious cycle of fear and mistrust. Finally, the recent visit to Boston of the presumed contender for the Taiwan presidency in 2008, Ma Ying-jeou, gave me renewed hope that a peaceful settlement of the Taiwan issue is really possible. Now, Ma was trained at Harvard Law School, and he's now mayor of Taipei, and he's chairman of the Nationalist Party. That's Chiang Kai-shek's old party. And Ma proposed many practical solutions for getting the cross-straits negotiations going again. He proposed setting aside the most contentious issue of sovereignty and focusing on less controversial measures, such as establishing direct air travel between Shanghai and Taipei, and also permitting PRC students to study at Taiwan's universities. And these new measures, were they accepted by both sides, could really enhance the evolutionary process of people-to-people exchanges that enhance goodwill across the straits. And business connections between Taiwan and China are already well-developed. So the pragmatic approach of Chairman Ma, as he was respectfully addressed by the PRC students in attendance, and to which he replied with a smile, "Watch your pronunciation," he demonstrates the extent to which incremental progress is possible through negotiation. A bellicose international environment bolsters hardliners in both the U.S. and China and enables politicians to continue to misallocate resources to buy more weapons rather than investing in the needs of their own people and also avoiding putting their own houses in order. So we need our friends in Europe to coax both America and China not to overreact to fears and to stay in the safe middle position on the Taiwan issue. Thank you.
You've been listening to a panel discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with the Department of International Relations at Boston University. The speakers were Angelos Pangratis, Deputy Head of Delegation of the European Commission in the United States, Wanwan Chen, Research Fellow at Harvard University's Center for the Environment China Project, and Shelley Hawks, Assistant Professor of Social Sciences at BU's College of General Studies. We began with a greeting by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and Matt Odette with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.